It's really lovely to see so many of you here, and I feel quite excited actually, and I'm really pleased that we've got a theme for the year that we're going to be concentrating our practice around in, well, in various formats and ways. And yeah, I feel excited and inspired and intrigued as to, well, both how the weekend's going to develop and how the year's going to develop, and intrigued by some of these things on our cushions. And yeah, well, obviously you're here because you want to be here, and it's touched something in you as well. So I'm just going to repeat how lovely it is to see you all. So I'm going to start with briefly exploring a few questions and setting the scene for what a Buddha land is and how it comes about. And there's a Mahayana text called the Vimalakirti Nirdesha that I'll be referring to, and looking at what it means for us now in the 21st century. I'll give some examples from my own life. And as Ataketu said, I'm mainly going to be talking about individual practice and Dainandi this afternoon on collective practice. But it's not quite as simple as that, because what we do affects the collective and the collective influences us. So it's not so straightforward as being able to separate them. Yeah, so there might be some overlap. So Buddhism is a means to an end, and that end is the spiritual development of the individual. And I think we need to keep sight of this. So building the Buddha land is about deepening our practice, an open dimension, individual expression, sharing our vision, and completely mysterious. So in the text that I just mentioned, the Vimalakirti Nirdesha, the Buddha is with a huge gathering, with thousands of different people. And Vimalakirti is there, and he's presented as a householder, like a man about town. But he's not what he seems. And in the first chapter, it's talking about building the Buddha land. And at some point, 500 Lichvi youths come along, and they circumambulate the Buddha and pay respect to him. And they've all got a parasol. So they come in each holding a parasol. So there are 500 parasols, which are the spiritual aspirations of those 500 youths. But then the Buddha transforms those 500 parasols into one huge canopy, and everything, all the worlds, all the world systems are seen in that canopy. So it's as though that those individual 500 aspirations converge and unite into one aspiration. And we need to see this poetically, not particularly literally. And this is really a symbol of the cosmic bodhicitta. And the bodhicitta is our desire for the well-being, for the enlightenment of all beings. And it's aware of and responds to all living beings. And the text says, the 500 parasols borne aloft, so brilliant and so colourful. These surely represent the spiritual aspirations of those 500 Lichvi youths. In particular, their aspiration to supreme perfect enlightenment for the benefit of all beings. In other words, the parasols represent the bodhicitta, the arisen bodhicitta, the thought of, or will to, supreme perfect enlightenment. It means that their aspirations tend to converge, to unite, to become one single aspiration. So what does the canopy represent? It represents what may be called, provided we take it poetically, what may be called the cosmic bodhicitta. So a Buddha land is a land infused with and permeated by the influence of a Buddha, where all aspects of life are touched and transformed by the wisdom and compassion of the Buddha. A Buddha land is people. It's all the people living their lives open to the influence of the Buddha, Dharma and Sangha, so that he can work through them and radically transform them. And Sangharakshita says, to the extent that our spiritual aspirations have a common object, they will be united, and to the extent that they're united, there'll be a force for good in the world. So in Buddhist cosmology, space is infinite, and it's occupied by infinite world systems. And there are 1,000 world systems make up one small universe. 1,000 small universes make up one middling universe. And 1,000 middling universes make up one great universe. And so we could go on and on. And a Buddha land is one great universe. So it holds all these, I don't know the maths of 1,000 times 1,000 times 1,000, but that's one great universe is that Buddha land. And it's a sphere of influence of one particular Buddha, who is responsible for maturing and ripening and leading all the living beings in that great universe to enlightenment. So the Buddha of that particular Buddha land is responsible for the spiritual welfare of all the people in one great universe, or even several great universes. And there are two types of Buddha land, pure and impure. So in an impure Buddha land, the basic necessities of life are hard to find, and it's difficult to hear the Dharma. And it includes the six realms of sentient beings, which some of you may be familiar with on the Wheel of Life. A pure land, by contrast, has highly conducive conditions where the sound of the Dharma is everywhere and food, etc., is easily obtainable. So it's one in which it's easy for living beings to evolve, easy for them to follow the path to enlightenment. It's very easy to hear the Dharma, and it's very easy to come in contact with Buddhas and Bodhisattvas. And a Buddha can transform an impure land into a pure land, which equates to building the Buddha land. And he can also create a pure land within an impure one. And in a way, that's what we're trying to do here at the MBC. So who builds the Buddha land? A Bodhisattva builds the Buddha land and sets up an ideal environment for the spiritual life. And he does so because of his or her Bodhisattva vows, which is a vow to lead all beings to enlightenment. And although they could create it single-handedly, in a way that wouldn't be the point, because they wouldn't be able to keep people in it indefinitely if they don't want to remain it. Other things would creep in. So it has to be a joint creation with other beings. It has to be built by a number of people working together. It has to be built by a number of bodhisattvas and would-be bodhisattvas working together, all inspired by the same ideal. The ideal of supreme, perfect enlightenment for the benefit of all. So why does a Bodhisattva... Well, we've found out why a Bodhisattva builds the Buddha land. But why is he concerned with people? There are like two ideals. An Arahat ideal, which is the salvation or emancipation for oneself alone, or the Bodhisattva ideal, where we help others. And as I said a little bit earlier, in a way they're not contradictory, because if we help ourselves, we help others. If we help others, we help ourselves. So we're evolving together in a free association with each other. And I think sometimes people fear that they're going to get lost in a group, somehow meld together in one amorphous mass where we all have to be the same. But it's not like that at all. We become more and more ourselves. And although we may have the same qualities, we express them in our own unique way. Although we may have a common vision, we express it in our own unique way. So the Buddha land is built with living beings who want to evolve, who want to become true individuals. Without people, there wouldn't be any Buddha land. In a sense, people are all you need. If you've got people, you've got everything. So how do the Bodhisattva and the budding Bodhisattvas build the Buddha land? By positive thought, high resolve, virtuous application. And then the text gives a list of Dharma teachings, like the six perfections, the 37 aids to enlightenment, the 10 precepts. And Mahabodhi's done a lot of these figures and quotes around the building, and some of those give more details of, well, how to practice in these different lists. So one of the things, one of the ideals that we're looking to bring into being is to, well, I was going to say gain insight. It is about gaining insight, but I think sometimes when we talk about gaining, it's as though we're grasping, we're trying to appropriate something. And I think sometimes it's more helpful to think of maybe losing something for something else to emerge. So what would we need to lose? We need to lose our ignorance and our wrong views, so that insight becomes natural, liberating. It's freedom, it's laying down a burden. So without insight, we remain with a sense of a fixed, separate self. And I was thinking about one of my, I think it is an enduring motivation for practicing, which is wanting to be free of everything that I feel holds me back. And a lot of that is to do with my conditioning, and but also an aspiration. Some of you may have heard of a Dakini, which is it's sometimes translated as a sky dancer, somebody who's really free, who's got spontaneous energy, who isn't inhibited and doesn't feel constrained by the society in which she lives. She's just, yeah, completely free. And it's a few years ago now, I was walking down the track at Toraloka, and at times I've really felt as though I've had a ball and chain around my foot. And I was walking down the track. Toraloka is a women's retreat centre in Shropshire. And saying, I want to die. I want to die to my limited self. And that just kept going through my mind over and over. And I ended up just feeling really lighter and lighter, and it's almost as though this desire to be free of what holds me back has made me do reflecting on it, it's almost like some weird things in my life, or weird in terms of how I view myself. So, well, just going back to when I lived at Taraloka, the thought that made me leave there was needing to work with my breath. And it was a sentence that I said, which was 20 years earlier when I'd first enrolled at yoga, I'd wanted to work with my breath. And here I was 20 years later, feeling that I hadn't done that. And there was something literal about it, of needing to breathe deeper, but I didn't really know what I meant. And that thought is what, not many months later, caused me to leave. It was as though I felt that I would suffocate if I left, if I stayed there any longer. And what I think might be like the weird bit is I didn't know what I was going to do after I left. I knew what I was going to do for 2 weeks. And then after that, I didn't know where I was going to live or what I was going to do. And that's not how I view myself. You know, I think of myself as very steadfast. And actually, I was recalling my life with somebody about a week ago. And it's as though every so often I do these kind of things that, yeah, as though something in me is being driven. And, you know, I don't feel as I'm very intuitive or whatever, but, yeah, it's as though I need to listen to this call within me. I want to seek to love. I feel as though that was a raison d'etre this life. And even if I'm in a meeting, and I say that to myself, it affects how I am with the people in the room. If I say when I'm walking down the street, the things that my eyes catch sight of somehow seem more vibrant and brighter. I want to open to reality, to the transcendental. On a gathering of order members a couple of years ago, it was just like this thought popped into my mind of all I need to do is realign myself more with the Buddha and my views will gradually drop away. And I didn't mean that in a psychologically premature way. It just felt a fact. You know, if I align myself more with the Buddha, all my views and my wrong views will drop away. And I just had this complete, it was very brief, but a sense of freedom and liberation and lightness. And it felt as though that was a response to a truth. And then a couple of days later, I felt completely threatened by that thought, by that sense of needing to let go of my views. So, you know, we have our aspirations, but then we don't always are able to live up to them, or there needs to be more catching up to do. So we're not aiming to do a really good version of what some of you may have heard recently of the ego project, but it's something completely radical. So although the Buddha land is made up of people, it's us sincerely practicing to transform ourselves. And it's like looking at the conditions alive in which that transformation can continue to take place, and in which we can open up more and more to these dharmic currents in the world, the influence of the Buddha, who's responsible for the Buddha land, the impure Buddha land in which we find ourselves. So actually I'm going to rush on quite a bit. I think we Yes, I've just said a little bit about a couple of the things that galvanise me, that motivate me. And it's as though we all need to be in touch with our own vision, our highest ideal, so that we are truly galvanised. And once we contact our vision, we live from that, and everything seems to emerge from that, and our vision lives through us. So how can we touch our vision? And how are we more fully to live from it? How can we be bold with our vision, our creation of a Buddha land, ourselves? So I think we need a passionate engagement with each other, a desire to practice more intensely with each other, where that energy of the darkening flows continuously rather than a stopping and starting. It's almost as though we need to get out of our own way and let the Dharma work through us. And again, there was a time when I lived at Toraloka, and I suddenly thought, actually, all we need to do is get people here. And the magic of the Dharma and the magic of Tara and her realm will have its influence on people. We just need to get them there. In the same way, we just need to have people coming here to the centre, and something happens, it will, our individual and collective practice will be having an effect on people as they walk through the door. So how can we build a Buddha land in Manchester? So we're going to be looking this morning about contacting our vision, and as I've said, the more we can keep in touch with that, and it can galvanise us. And I was thinking how, well, just this very building, the MBC, and what happened when it was bought in 1994 and then opened in 96, you know, the literal transformation of this building, the vision of building a Buddha land in Manchester being behind that, so that we created the conditions that more and more people could partake of the Dharma. And I've got such regard and appreciation for everybody who was involved in this building project to enable us to be here. So we're a sangha of true individuals emerging, a community of inquiry, exploring life together, exploring practice together, to go deeper and deeper. And we all play a part, and we need to find ways that are unique to us. We need to involve our hearts, our guts, everything. Offer all of ourselves to this noble quest. And have the courage and authenticity to see ourselves as we are. Be interested, fascinated even with ourselves. Okay, so in these conditions, this is how I respond. In those conditions, that's how I respond. And one of the things that I really want to do is to encourage each of us to value what we're all doing, what we're contributing to the cosmic drama, because it's happening already. I was thinking on a convention, on a combined convention, there were about 500 of us there, and we meet every 2 years. And I thought, oh, actually, since we last met, that's 1,000 years of practice that has gone on. And it really quite bowled me over. So it's as though we think we go on in our own individual way, but when we come together, something else happens. So I don't know how many, could we be 50 in this room? So, you know, even from the last week, from last Saturday, we've got one year of practice now between us. So, you know, it's all, it all adds up, you know. So I think we need to really value what we're doing. and not compare ourselves with others. And I think we can aspire to be like others in terms of the qualities that they embody. But often I think when we compare ourselves, we're comparing ourselves less favourably. And we are all practicing, and it was a bit odd, I was going to say, you know, we've got a right to practice, you know, we've got a right to value what we're doing. We're all different with our different strengths and qualities. And we practice with what we've got in any given moment, whether we're happy, sad, euphoric, fed up, depressed, dull, inspired, whether we're deluded, whether we feel empathetic, self-righteous, whatever we're practicing with, whatever we're experiencing and whoever we are. You know, we can't be happy all the time. You know, the ups and downs of the, well, there are ups and downs of the spiritual life, and I think we need to take those, really recognise that that is a part of the spiritual life. So we're not just building the Buddha land when we're inspired and everything's going fine. We're building it through our tough times, when we're digging deeper into ourselves, when we're digging the foundations of the Buddha land within us. And, you know, we might find cracked vessels, and we might find jewels as well. And I just wanted to say a few things about how how we can take our practice seriously and value it, and just a few pointers in relation to how we might practice. And I don't mean this in a rah-rah way, or it's what you've got to do, because we need to find our own expression, our own uniqueness and our own expression of our ideals. But we can think in terms of like authenticity, rather than, for example, good meditations. You know, we're just with ourselves as we meditate. We can relate to our practice as a truthful turning towards our experience. We can deepen our practice of ethics, develop our friendships, particularly our peer friendships. We can really appreciate the spiritual community in practicing with others. We can rejoice in ourselves. We can try to become kinder each day, even. We can let go of unskillful habits. Think more in terms of interconnectedness, letting go of me and mine. Being appropriately challenging. Being less attached to a sense of self. We could admit our faults and apologise easily. We could be open to what people say and not be reactive. We could talk about death and loss. We could notice more the beginning and end of our breaths and the constant change. Each in-breath a new beginning, each out-breath a letting go. We could do one thing differently this week to counter our I'm not the kind of person who ... and see how it feels. We could think about freedom, encourage ourselves with positive mental states. We could exemplify reverence in the shrine room. We could not be shy about communicating, wanting to emulate the Buddha, or about our belief in our potential for change. We can read about the Buddha. We can find out what inspires us. We can stop and relax, turn towards our experience. We can not be afraid of being idealistic. we can have a tea break in silence. We can really listen to ourselves and other people. And if we can do this, if we can overcome and transcend our self-referentiality, if we see things as they really are, we can enter the mystery of it all, know that it's completely ungraspable, and allow and trust the Dharma to work through us. Then we'll have created a Buddha land. So let us continue to be radical, in touch with what is most important and of true value to us, in touch with the transformative nature of the Dharma. Let us deepen our inspiration and aspiration and understanding of the Dharma. Let us be bold in this suffering world. Let us build the Buddha land together. So a Buddha land is not a building, not even this beautiful building, but all our highest ideals finding expression in all facets of our lives. Where, like the parasols of the Lichfa youths, our individual aspirations join together to make something much, much bigger, in one sense, out of this world perhaps, yet a Buddha land here in Manchester, in the midst of this impure world. So we're going to have a silent toilet break now, and when we come back, Singha Sri is going to take over, and there will be a couple of questions to contemplate then, which I'll just read them now, but Singha Sri is going to talk a little bit more. So just consider, what is your individual vision? What are your highest ideals? And how can you manifest them in everyday life? And what conditions do I create to help me? What conditions do I need to realise those highest ideals? Okay, thank you.